Bless you, mate.
Morning. Exodus chapter 19. If you could have the words on the screen, then. Exodus 19. Verse 1. That's it. Okay. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out from the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken we will do." And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud, in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe in you forever." Then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Verse 4 says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." The 29th of November last year would have been my father's birthday. He's been gone for a long time, so it wasn't really desperately upsetting. But because my dad had married late, even though I claim I'm still young, it would actually have been his 105th birthday. And I was trying to get my head around the fact that he would be 105. But just before Christmas, I found myself at a funeral. And the funeral was of a lady called Dorothy, and she was the sister of my dad's best friend. She was also his classmate in school. So she was 104. And she would have been 105 on the 1st of April this year. She'd obviously had a long life. She'd had a very rich kind of life, not financially, but she, after leaving the school where she went with my dad, she came back as the teacher. So there were a lot of people I'd grown up amongst who were in their 80s. Who had been her pupils in school. She'd been a teacher around the country. She retired back to Hereford. She learned to play the harp. She became a harpist and she became a harp teacher. She was very artistic. She'd had a life that had got problems in it, but it had been a long life and it had been a rich life. And at some point, it must have been in her early 20s, she would have walked up the aisle at one of the local chapels. And like so many of her generation, she was following Jesus. I was at the NEC in Birmingham at a Reinhard Bonnke conference in an intercession seminar, which was a long way removed from the chapel she would have grown up in, and she was there. So she was someone who had lived a long, rich life. And while funerals are never easy, that was maybe one of the better ones. But we know that it's not always like that. And that, I think, is in all of our minds at the moment. Exodus 19, verse 4, comes at a kind of turning point in the story of the children of Israel. Until now, we've been given an account of how God released the children of Israel from Egypt. And he's about to establish a covenant with these people. If you remember the story of Joseph, he'd become a kind of prime minister to the Pharaoh in Egypt about 400 years before. And his family had moved into Egypt to join him. They were obviously given some very good land to farm. But time had passed. The Pharaohs had got jealous of the Israelites. The Pharaohs had made them into slaves, and they were making bricks. But the people are crying out to God to be released. And God calls them out of Egypt, and he sets them free from slavery. And you may know the story that Moses is called by God from the burning bush, and God demonstrates his authority over Pharaoh by getting Moses to confront him. And then we have the story of the plagues, and eventually Pharaoh lets the people go. And God leads them through the Red Sea by parting the waters. And now at this point in the story, we're into a kind of new episode where God is going to establish a covenant. He's establishing a relationship, if you like, with the people. And so Moses has to go up the mountains, and he gets the Ten Commandments and pages of ways and rules and regulations and ways to live your life. And God establishes the law. He establishes what we call the Mosaic Covenant, the covenant of Moses. It follows on from a covenant that God had made with Abraham in Genesis. And it shows God's people how they were to live out their lives as God's people, what they were to do. It affects every aspect of their lives. It affects their personal lives, their social lives, their spiritual lives. It's about the whole of their lives. But it's also a covenant that is conditional. And they have to play their part. But then as we look through the history of the children of Israel, we see they don't manage to keep the covenant. They manage to break the Ten Commandments, they break everything else. God intervenes. God has to intervene. He sends Jesus to do what they couldn't do for themselves and what we can't do for ourselves. And this covenant shows us in a very clear way why we need Jesus. But here we get the verse that comes between the story of the children of Israel being freed from Egypt and the establishment of the covenant. And this verse, in a way, it gets to the heart of the matter. This is what the history of the children of Israel was all about. It was why God was seeking to establish a covenant with them. You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and I brought you to myself. And first of all, God says, you have seen, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. I think we can look at that the wrong way. That God is maybe boasting, but he's not. God gets a bad press sometimes. When we think of the Old Testament, we almost get the idea that God's got anger issues. He seems to send fire and bring stone and floods. And also when we get pictures that we remember from the Old Testament, the scenes are very often scenes of like judgment or destruction. I suppose they're the kind of easier to visual in our minds, imagine in our minds than some other stories. But God doesn't really get his kicks from bad stuff happening to people. But we know that bad stuff happens in life. And God does get angry. But then there's plenty to get angry about. Someone might say, well, why was God so cruel to the Egyptians? And the answer would be, well, he was going to free the slaves. So we could then say, well, why didn't he free them earlier? The Egyptians were holding on to another people group as slaves. These people were crying out to God, and God was calling those people to be his own people. Pharaoh would have seen himself as a kind of almost divine figure. He would have seen himself as a kind of go-between between the people and God, and he believed that when he died, he was going to become a god. Pharaoh would have seen himself as having some kind of spiritual authority. And that would have been a challenge to God and God's spiritual authority. And there was a kind of spiritual battle going on. The Egyptians were holding on to God's people as slaves because they believed they had the right to do so. But God hates evil, and it makes him angry. And God will take on evil. But it doesn't mean that he enjoys it when people hold on to evil. Ezekiel 33:11. You got that one down? Ezekiel 33:11. Oh, yeah, great. Say to them, as I live, declares the Lord, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn back from your evil ways. Then why will you die, O house of Israel? I take no pleasure, Lord says, in the death of the wicked. And God calls Moses. We could say some things about Moses. He survived a genocide when the Hebrew baby boys were being killed at birth. He was brought up as an Egyptian, no doubt thinking like an Egyptian and identifying as an Egyptian at some stage in his life. But then he killed an Egyptian. It's like he wasn't waiting for God's timing. He takes the law into his own hands. And he goes and kills one of the Egyptian slave drivers. And it doesn't look like he was very good with people, because when he tried to stop a fight between a couple of the slaves, it goes wrong and Moses has to go into hiding. We're told he was less than confident. He was a very poor speaker. And we're told that he hid out in the desert, because he was in trouble, his life was in danger, he had to run and hide in the desert. Exodus 3, 1 to 12. Now Moses was pastoring the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire in the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire. Yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He also said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, and to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought this people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. This shall be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Moses could well say, what do you mean when? Don't you mean if? He gives Moses a sign. When you worship me at this mountain, that will be the sign. God works supernaturally. He takes Moses, who was inadequate, and he gets him to confront Pharaoh. He gets him to confront all the powers that Pharaoh represented, all the belief system that Pharaoh had, all the ideas he got that he was somebody special in the eyes of his gods. He gets Moses to exercise spiritual power in front of this man. And Moses has to, in a way, stare down a whole system of evil that was holding God's people captive. And God sets his people free. And he breaks the power of evil that was holding his people as slaves. And then we get the story in Genesis 19 where we began, that Moses has brought the people and they are worshipping God at the mountain. God has said that that is the sign that he sent Moses. So God says, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. The people had lived through it, and they'd seen it. But then God goes on to say, I bore you on eagle's wings. The people are delivered in God's strength, not in their own. God bore them on eagle's wings. I suppose if Moses had never encountered the burning bush, left to his own devices, he would have spent the rest of his life in the desert as a shepherd with the sheep. Instead of that, he meets with God and he finds himself facing down this whole system that was opposed to the will of God. And yet it wasn't actually about Moses, and it wasn't actually done in Moses' strength, because it was always about God. God said in Exodus 3:8, he said, I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians. So we have the story of the plagues, the Passover, when the death strikes the Egyptians but not the Israelites. And the Red Sea parts and the people walk through on dry land. And this becomes a kind of defining moment in their history. And there is a sea that is uncrossable between where they were and where they've come to. They were slaves in Egypt, and now they're entering into a covenant with God. And they're entering into a relationship with God. And that sea opening up and letting them through and then covering over again, that is a sign. The waters have closed behind them, and the waters have closed over top of the Pharaoh. People are worshipping God at the mountain, and behind them is a sea they can't cross to go back. This was God's doings. Moses wouldn't have got them out of Israel, out of Egypt, if he'd relied on his charismatic personality, because I don't think he had a charismatic personality. He wouldn't have got them out with winning words, because he wasn't very good with words. And it looks like maybe he wasn't very good with his people skills either. So this was done in God's power as part of God's plan. There was no way that the Israelites could argue with it. There was no way that the Israelites could argue that God hadn't brought them out. The truth is, sometimes they didn't see it that way. And they did doubt God. But really, this is a picture for us today of where we are as Christians. We're Christians who are saved by grace. God has done it. It's not what we've done. Things happen in life that unsettle us, make us insecure. You get bad and unexpected events. They make us question things. But how strong is your God? I don't like flying. I can scare other people on the plane when it's taking off. I haven't been on the plane for nearly 10 years, which isn't because I'm avoiding planes. No, it's just I haven't. But I'm quite happy to be where I am on the ground. And you start thinking stupid things like, what if the wings fall off? And you look at an aeroplane and you see these great big heavy jet engines stuck onto these wings, and then you know there are big fuel tanks in there, and you're thinking, how much do they weigh? And this is all hanging off the wing, and this thing's supposed to be keeping me up in the air. And sometimes when it gets a bit rough, I think the wings seem to flap a little bit. But I've been told I'm looking at it the wrong way. I imagine these wings are fixed onto the side of the fuselage. And I'm the sort of person, if I go to Butlins and go on one of the rides, I look to see where the bolts are and see if they've actually got nuts on them. So I worry about whether these wings are actually bolted onto the side. But I've been told that's not actually what it's about. Hello. Oh, sorry. I don't trust technical stuff. Okay. So, aeroplanes and bolts. I was told I'm looking at it the wrong way. That the wings are what the aeroplane is actually all about. The bit that I sit in is sitting on top of the wings. So rather than thinking that the wings are actually bolted onto the plane is actually bolted onto the wings. Or at least that's what I've been told. So that's supposed to help. But it doesn't look like it to me. So can we trust that the wings aren't going to fall off our own lives? And it does depend what we're using as wings. And here God is talking about eagle's wings. This is at the heart of being a Christian. The children of Israel were about to make this covenant with God. It was a conditional part, conditional covenant. They had to do their part. God had to do his. And we know that they failed. They messed it up. It doesn't take them long to mess up. Moses comes down from the mountain. They're worshipping a god of their own making. Exodus 32:1-4. Thanks. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. They took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Moses hadn't returned from the mountain. The man who'd brought them up from the land of Egypt isn't with them. What did they say? "As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So they make something for themselves. They make a God that they can manage. A nice tame God they can get their heads round. God they can shape and mould in their own image, a small, safe one. But what the great big God that they'd turned their backs on had done for them was greater than they actually understood. Because this man Moses wasn't with them, didn't mean that they hadn't experienced a miracle. It wasn't about what Moses had done. And it wasn't about some small God that they could shape out of gold in their own imagination was able had done for them. This was God's handiwork. This can, I think, raise some questions for us in our own lives. Firstly, are we following Jesus because someone else around us is following him? Maybe there's some cool guy on God TV who seems to have it all together. Maybe it's some old Sunday school teacher we had a long time ago. Maybe it's someone we see on a Sunday morning. Or we can follow because they are. But then this Moses we trust, this man, he's gone up the mountain. And he doesn't come back to suit our schedule. Do we still trust in God? Or do we find something smaller, something more manageable that we can trust in? When the person we trust lets us down, when the person we trust fails to do something, when the person we trust doesn't follow through on something that they promised to do, we can turn to small gods of self-pity, rejection, bitterness, if we rely on the man. I've seen people become Christians, they get excited about the lovely people they're meeting in church. I find myself thinking, give it time. Lovely people are lovely, but they let you down. They make mistakes. It's not they're not bad people. They're lovely people. But they're not God. They can be a blessing. But sometimes they can challenge you. And when your Moses is up the mountain, and when someone lets you down, and when something happens that you can't get your head around, where do you turn? Another question, do we really understand the meaning of salvation? These people were free from slavery. They were now free to follow God, and the Red Sea had opened and then closed. There was this supernatural deliverance, but did they understand that it was God who'd done this? It wasn't just some man. They were called to live as God's blessed, chosen people. God was working in them, shaping a new nation for himself. It wasn't something a small God could do. Maybe some of them thought it was a lucky wind that just happened to blow at the right time. It must have been some kind of wind, but maybe in their minds they were starting to think that kind of thing. They were looking for some kind of rational explanation for what had happened. Some kind of reason why strange, unusual things had happened. Look back at something and try to fit it into everything around and not realize what salvation really meant. It wasn't just something that you can fit into everything else around it, but this was something supernatural that had happened. And also, do we understand the greatness of God? Exodus 3, 21, 22. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus, you will plunder the Egyptians. This was God's instructions before the people left. Basically, they were to plunder the Egyptians. The children of Israel didn't leave empty-handed. They'd been slaves for over 400 years, and they were owed some money, and God provided for them. But when they were free, after being freed by God himself, they're using the very gold that God had provided for them to make this small god that they could worship. And what they were doing was worshiping the blessings that God had given them rather than God himself. And I think it's possible if you've been freed from something in your lifestyle that you can even worship that freedom and not God. You can take the gold, take the freedom from the brick making, and use that freedom to turn back and worship the very gold that God had given you. But God is greater than the blessings that he provides. So it wasn't some golden calf that set the people free. It wasn't some lucky series of events. It was that God had provided that gold for them. God had caused the sea to part to let them through. And now the sea was closed behind them, and they had the gold, but they're worshipping the gold. Those eagle's wings that God bore the children of Israel on are strong wings. They're not wings that fall off at 35,000 feet. They're wings that carry you, and they are wings that are underneath you as you're traveling, as you are brought through. God picks you up and carries you to himself in his own strength. And if you are a Christian, that is something that you have already experienced. And surely that can be part of our lives day by day. God says, grab the gold. We're actually going to walk through the sea. And he says that we can trust in him because we're going to soar on his wings. He says, you've seen what I've done to the Egyptians, and now you are born on eagle's wings. Eagle's wings, strong wings, wings you can trust in. And when the going gets tough, we just trust in those wings. We don't have to try and flap on our own. So we're born on eagle's wings, and God says finally, I brought you to myself. I brought you to myself. It's about relationship and not religion. Often you hear a preacher say, God has a plan for your life. And that's good news for us. But it's also very simple. God has a plan for your life, and it's that he brings you to himself. God's plan for your life is relationship with him. The burning bush was something spectacular when God called Moses. Then the plagues of Egypt were spectacular. And the crossing of the Red Sea was spectacular. But God was not showing off. Sometimes you go and see a movie that's got lots of special effects in it, and it's hyped up for the special effects, and then you realize there's not really an awful lot of plot. There's not a lot going on. But this isn't like that. The spectacular things were just stuff that happened. There was a much bigger plot. He takes us, he carries us, and he brings us to where he wants us to be. And God wants us in relationship with him. Imagine you were taken to some parts of the world which was very different, where the culture was different, and the language and climate were all different. And you found there was no church there, no Bible, no worship music. Spring harvest last year, I remember listening to a lady who was from North Korea. She'd been in a prison. They worshipped God in the toilets. Very quietly, they sang Amazing Grace. In that situation, is God still with you? If the trappings of your religious life are taken away, is God still with you? And if you're put in solitary confinement, are you really alone? Because the lesson the children of Israel were learning in the desert was that God was staying with them and leading them. He wasn't just bringing them out of the bad place. He'd heard their cries. He'd heard their prayers to be freed. But they didn't really like being in the desert. And sometimes they even wanted to go back. But he was establishing a relationship with them. And we need to recognize that God's done a miracle in our lives. And he doesn't do a miracle so he gets more followers, bigger churches. He does it because he wants to bring people to himself. He wants relationship with people. And it's something that he has done. So we don't hang on by some weak thread. We're carried by wings that don't fall off. Wings that are underneath you and wings that lift you up. A couple of times recently I've been touched by these words from the song In Christ Alone. No guilt in life, no fear in death. This is the power of Christ in me. From life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. No power of hell, no scheme of man can ever pluck me from his hand. Till he returns or calls me home, here in the power of Christ, I'll stand. For some reason, I also thought of a verse from a hymn that was in the school hymn book. Younger. John Bunyan. He said, "Hobgoblin nor foul fiend can daunt his spirit. He knows he at the end shall life inherit." I've never seen a hobgoblin. There are a few foul fiends around. But he knows he at the end shall life inherit, or in Christ alone. Here in the power of Christ I'll stand. Romans 8. 31. If God is for us, who is against us? He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him over for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Who will bring a charge against God's elect? God is the one who justifies. Who is the one who condemns? Christ Jesus is he who died, yes, rather who was raised, who is at the right hand of God, who also intercedes for us. Who will separate us from the love of Christ? Will tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? Just as it is written, for your sake we have been put to death all day long. We were considered as sheep to be slaughtered. But in all these things we overwhelmingly conquer through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing will be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Compared to the children of Israel, we're at an advantage because they were led into the desert and God established a covenant with them that was conditional. They had to do their part and God did his. And this covenant, I believe, was used by God to highlight the fact that we cannot do it on our own. Mankind is unable to get it right. God called people out of Egypt, and they became his chosen people, his nation. But they failed. But into that nation and into that people, Jesus was born. And Jesus stands in our place, and it's in Jesus Christ that we can trust. And it's Jesus Christ who fulfills where we fail. It's Jesus who takes the consequences of the failures and takes the guilt of our association with evil. And I believe it's Jesus who carries our pain. I want to finish with a personal story. I don't really want to go into too much detail, but just to say, in my mid-20s, my family went through a difficult bereavement. And as we all know with these things, you go into shock, you go into grief. You have to handle your own shock and grief and that of your immediate family. And I found also of the community around. It's okay when you go to places where people are expecting to see you, but you walk into the local shop or somebody sees you in the street and you have to handle their reaction as well as yours. And I think for a period of about 2 years, I found I was going through the motions of life in general. But underneath, I was shutting down. You just keep going because you have to. And I don't know how many people were aware of it at the time. I did have people around me who got quite a lot of insight but didn't actually say a lot, and they may have seen what was happening. But during this period of about 2 years, I started to question everything. And question what I believed, or if I believed. And I did get to the stage where I was quite coldly making the decision about what had I got left and what did I believe in. And it was like I'd shut down. And I was thinking, well, you know, how do you go about living as someone who's not a Christian? How do I do that? I've got like lots of Christian music tapes, and it was a long time ago I had tapes. Do I put them in the loft? I don't know. I made a cold decision, and I'd say it was a very cold decision that I wasn't going to walk away. There wasn't much left, but I would say that I found that I could turn my back on everything except one thing, which was that there was a relationship there that I could not explain. And I could not explain it away because it was something that was real. And I believe that as I made that cold decision to turn one way and not the other, that I actually believe I fell into the arms of a loving father. And in within 12 months, my faith was growing in a way it had never grown before. It was quite an amazing thing that happened. And I was left with questions in my life. But I knew that I'd got God with me. And I knew that God had done something in my life that I couldn't explain away, I couldn't deny. And I knew that I could trust God, not just trust God, but also trust God with the questions that I'd been left with. And I just leave the questions with God. And I know that when I wasn't there for God, God was still there for me, and he was waiting. And I believe that's that says an awful lot about what it means to be a Christian. That God has done something in our lives, no matter where we are, no matter how we feel, no matter how much we feel that we're shutting down, God has done what it takes, and God is carrying us, and he's carrying us into this relationship with him, a relationship where he's not going anywhere. And we have a relationship with God that will not come to an end now or forever. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians." God faced down the evil. He set his people free. He said, "I bore you on eagle's wings. The people are delivered in God's strength, not in their own." And he says, "I brought you to myself," because it's about relationship. And it's not about religion. Okay.